Building true face-to-face relationships is one of our society's most pressing and important problems. Our generation has lost touch with what it means to have a real relationship, and we are paying for it now. It's not that people don't want to build relationships, they just don't know how anymore. Deep, meaningful relationships take time, but the rewards are worth it. Today's episode will focus on how to make that dream a reality. Welcome to the Readout Podcast. I'm your host, Jake Welchens, and for the past 10 years, I've been helping young leaders reach their potential. At Readout, our belief is that to lead out, you have to read out. And to read out means to read well and to read broadly. Almost every great leader in history has been a reader, and we wholeheartedly agree with Margaret Fuller when she said, "Today a reader, tomorrow a leader." Reading is not optional to leadership. It's not the side dish, it's the main course. And in order to become a great leader, you have to dig in. But here's the problem. We here at Readout know that in this day and age, time and energy is hard to come by. My hope is to save you that time and energy and bring you the best books that can have impact in your life right now. Then I want to teach you to get the most out of these books so that you can become the reader you've always dreamed of being faster than you ever imagined. Our dream is to create a movement of young adults passionate about reading and dangerously effective at leading. Hey, thank you to everyone who's sharing and reviewing us. We really need your help. I truly appreciate that you would take the time to do that. So anyone sharing on social media or sharing to your friends on group chats or whatever, I really appreciate you taking the time to share what we're doing. We need to build this movement together, and we really appreciate you guys. Welcome to episode 4 of our new series called Your Next Chapter. In this series, we'll take one of our recommended books and then read and analyze one of its best chapters. From start to finish, we'll have you pumping literary iron on the best content from the best books. Think of it as a crash course for instant application or a mini audiobook where you get to skip the fluff. At Readout, we don't just read books, we apply them and master them. So here's to today's chapter. Today's chapter comes from Digital Minimalism by Cal Newport. If you want to check out our episode about the book, go back to the book that unhacks your life and check it out. Again, this is one of those books where it's really hard to choose just one chapter because they're all so rich and applicable, but this was the chapter where we felt like would most be useful for those of us in the digital age. Relationships are important, and unfortunately, one of the main obstacles facing our generation is the inability to build deep, meaningful, impactful relationships. This chapter helps a ton. What we're going to do today is read the chapter together, and I'll stop 2 to 3 times to further elaborate on a couple key sections to get you applying this amazing piece of leadership art. Without further ado, let's jump in. Don't click like. The greatest duel in sports. In 2007, ESPN aired what has to be one of the strangest sporting events to ever appear on the channel, the National Championship of the USA Rock Paper Scissors League. The title match, which is preserved on YouTube, begins with the play-by-play announcers excitedly describing the two RPS phenoms, RPS being short for Rock Paper Scissors, that will be competing, declaring with deadpan seriousness that the audience is about to witness the greatest duel in sports. The competition is held in a mini boxing ring with a podium in the middle. The first contestant wears glasses and is dressed in khaki pants and a short-sleeve button-down shirt. He trips on the ropes trying to climb into the ring. His nickname, we're told, is Landshark. The second contestant, nicknamed The Brain, arrives also dressed in khakis. He makes it into the ring without falling over. That bodes well, the announcer helpfully explains. A referee enters and chops his hand over the podium to start the first match. Both players do a 3 count with their fist before throwing down their signs. The Brain chooses paper, while the Landshark chooses scissors. Point to the Landshark, the crowd cheers. A little less than 3 minutes later, with the score in his favor, Landshark wins the championship and the $50,000 grand prize by smothering the Brain's rock with what the announcers call the paper heard around the world. On first encounter, the idea of serious rock-paper-scissors matches might sound silly. Unlike poker or chess, there doesn't seem to be any room for strategy, which, if true, would make the outcome of a given tournament essentially random. Except this is not what actually happens. During the peak of the league's popularity in the early 2000s, the same high-skilled players kept ending up near the top of the tournament rankings, and when accomplished players compete against novices, the role of skill becomes even more pronounced. In a promotional video produced by the National League, a tournament-caliber player who goes by the name of Master Roshambala challenges strangers to pick up games in Las Vegas hotel lobbies. He wins almost every time. The explanation for these results is that rock, paper, scissors, contrary to initial assumption, requires strategy. What separates advanced players like The Brain and Landshark and Master Roshambala from RPS mortals, however, is not a tediously memorized sequence of plays or statistical wizardry. It is instead their sophisticated grasp of a much broader topic, human psychology. A strong rock, paper, scissors player integrates a rich stream of information about their opponent's body language and recent plays to help approximate their opponent's mental state and therefore make an educated guess about the next play. These players will also use subtle movements and phrases to prime their opponents to think about a certain play. The opponent, however, might notice the priming attempt and adjust their play accordingly. Of course, the original player might expect this and execute a tertiary adjustment, and so on. It should come as no surprise that participants in rock, paper, scissors tournaments often describe the experience as exhausting. To see some of these dynamics in action, let's return to the first throw of the 2007 championship match described above. Right before the players begin their three count, The Brain says, "Let's roll." This seems innocuous, but as the play-by-play announcer notes, this is a subliminal call for his opponent to play rock. The idea of rolling primes the mind to think about rocks. After planting this seed to nudge his opponent towards rock, The Brain plays paper. The subliminal strategy, however, backfires. Landshark notices it and guesses what The Brain is up to, so he plays scissors, beating The Brain's paper and winning the throw. Understanding rock, paper, scissors champions is important to our purposes because their strategies highlight a foundational endowment shared by every human being on Earth, the ability to perform complicated social thinking. To put this ability to use for the narrow purpose of winning an RPS throw requires some game-specific practice, but as I'll elaborate below, most people don't realize the extreme degree to which they perform similarly demanding feats of social navigation and mind reading throughout their normal everyday interactions. Our brains, in many ways, can be understood as sophisticated social computers. A natural conclusion of this reality is that we should treat with great care any new technology that threatens to disrupt the ways in which we connect and communicate with others. When you mess with something so central to the success of our species, it's easy to create problems. Okay, let's step out and talk about this point for a second. I think it's a really good point from Cal. I love this point and I totally agree. Technology has increased at an exponential rate, and I love it. But we need to be wary of advances that pull away from our personal success versus accelerate it. I have a Google Mini, for example. It was awesome at first, but now I spend most every day trying to work out the bugs to get it connected to my phone or to Apple Music or something else. Every single day. But I've been loath to tell myself to get rid of it because, well, it's supposed to make my life better. And I might figure it out. Here's what I need to do. I need to ditch it. It's pulling away valuable time of my life doing the most life-giving activities. What technology do you keep making excuses for? Is it an app that you know is not setting you up to thrive or some gadget that actually is making life more complicated like my Google Mini? Spend time thinking through the technology you use. Make a column, one positive, one negative. Anything that adds to you thriving, put it in the positive category. Anything that takes away, put in the negative. Be honest, technology should only serve to advance your life and goals. All right, back to the book. In the pages ahead, I'll detail the ways in which our brains evolved to crave rich social interaction and then explore the serious issues caused when we displace this interaction with highly appealing but much less substantial electronic pings. I'll then conclude by suggesting a somewhat radical strategy for the digital minimalist looking to sidestep these harms while maintaining the advantages of new communication tools, a strategy that puts these new forms of interaction to work, supporting the old. The social animal. The idea that humans have a particular affinity for interaction and communication is not new. Aristotle famously noted that man is by nature a social animal. It wasn't, however, until surprisingly recently, in the long sweep of human history, that we discovered the biological extent to which this philosophical intuition turns out to be true. A key moment in this new understanding came in 1997 when a research team from Washington University published a pair of papers in the prestigious Journal of Cognitive Neuroscience. During this period, PET scanners, which were originally developed for medical purposes, were migrating into neuroscience research, where they provided researchers the breakthrough ability to observe brain activity. The Washington University team looked at a collection of these new brain imaging studies to investigate a simple question. Are there regions of the brain that are involved in all types of brain activity? As the psychologist Matthew Lieberman summarized in his 2013 book, Social, the results of this initial analysis were disappointing, revealing that only a few regions showed increased activity across all the tasks, and they weren't very interesting brain regions. But the research team wasn't done. After failing to find regions that fired for many different activities, they decided to ask the opposite question. What, if anything, is active in the brain when someone is not trying to do a task? It was an unusual question, notes Lieberman. But we should be glad they asked because it led to a remarkable discovery. The team found that there's a particular set of regions in the brain that consistently activate when you're not attempting to do a cognitive task, and that just as consistently deactivate once you focus your attention on something specific. Because almost any task causes this network to deactivate, the researchers originally called it the task-induced deactivation network. Because this name was a mouthful, it was eventually abbreviated to a catchier label, the default network. At first, scientists had no idea what the default network did. They had a long list of tasks that it turned off, telling them what it didn't do, but little hard evidence about its true purpose. Even with a good evidence, however, scientists began to develop intuitions based on their own experience. One of these pioneering thinkers is our guide to this research, Matthew Lieberman, who now enters our narrative as an active participant. As Lieberman recalls, images of the default network were typically produced by asking a subject in a PET scanner to take a break from whatever repetitive activity the experiment required. Because the subject wasn't engaged in a specific task, it was easy for researchers to think of the default network as something that comes on when you're thinking about nothing. A little self-reflection, however, makes clear that our brains are hardly ever actually thinking about nothing. Even without a specific task, they tend to remain highly active, with thoughts and ideas flitting by in an ongoing noisy chatter. On further self-reflection, Lieberman realized that this background hum of activity tends to focus on a small number of targets. Thoughts about other people, yourself, or both. The default network, in other words, seems to be connected to social cognition. Sure enough, one scientist knew what to look for. They discovered that the regions of the brain that define the default network are virtually identical to the networks that light up during the social cognition experiments. When given downtime, in other words, our brain defaults to thinking about our social life. It's here that Lieberman's research takes an interesting twist. When he first encountered the conclusion that the default network is social, he wasn't impressed. Like others in his field, he noted that people naturally have a strong interest in their own social life, so it's not surprising that this is what they like to think about when bored. As Lieberman continued to study different aspects of social cognition, however, his opinion shifted. I have since become convinced that I had the relationship between these networks backward, he writes, and this reversal is tremendously important. He now believes we are interested in the social world because we are built to turn on the default network during our free time. Put another way, our brains adapted to automatically practice social thinking during any moments of cognitive downtime. And it's this practice that helps us become really interested in our social world. Lieberman and his collaborators devised a clever series of experiments to confirm this hypothesis. In one study, for example, they found that the default network lights up during downtimes, even in newborns. The importance of finding this activity in infants is that they clearly haven't cultivated an interest in the social world yet. The infant studied cannot even focus their eyes. This behavior must therefore be instinctual. In another study, researchers put adult subjects in a scanner and asked them to solve math problems. They discovered that when they gave the subjects a 3-second break between problems, a duration too short for them to decide to start thinking about something else, the default network still fired up to fill the small gap, further indicating that this drive to think about social issues kicks in like reflex. This finding underscores the fundamental importance of social connections to human well-being. As Lieberman summarizes, the brain did not evolve over millions of years to spend its free time practicing something irrelevant to our lives. But the default network is not the whole story. Additional studies by Lieberman and his collaborators uncovered other examples where evolution placed big bets on the importance of sociality by adapting other expensive systems to serve its needs. The loss of social connection, for example, turns out to trigger the same system as physical pain, explaining why the death of a family member, a breakup, or even just a social snub can cause such distress. In one simple experiment, it was discovered that over-the-counter painkillers reduce social pain. Given the power of the pain system in driving our behavior, its connection to our social life underscores the importance of social relationship to our species' success. Lieberman also discovered that the human brain devotes significant resources to two different major networks that work together toward the goal of mentalizing, helping us to understand other people's minds, including how they are feeling and their intentions. Something as simple as a casual conversation with a store clerk requires massive amounts of neuronal computational power to take in and process a high bandwidth stream of clues about what's going on in the clerk's mind. Though this mind reading feels natural to us, it's actually an amazingly complicated feat performed by networks owned over millions of years. It's exactly these highly adapted systems that are leveraged by the rock, paper, scissor champions who open this chapter. These experiments represent only some key highlights among many from a vast social cognitive neuroscience literature that all point to the same conclusion. Humans are wired to be social. In other words, Aristotle was on the right track when he called us social animals, but it took the modern invention of advanced brain scanners to help us figure out how much he was likely understanding this reality. This highly adapted human interest in social connections is a fascinating piece of our history. It also is, however, a reality that should concern any digital minimalist. The intricate brain networks described above evolved over millions of years in environments where interactions were always rich face-to-face encounters and social groups were small and tribal. The past few decades, by contrast, are characterized by the rapid spread of digital communication tools. My name for apps, services, or sites that enable people to interact through digital networks, which have pushed people's social networks to be much larger and much less local, while encouraging interactions through short text-based messages and approval clicks that are orders of magnitude less information-laden than what we have evolved to expect. Perhaps predictably, the clash of old neural systems with modern innovations has caused problems. Much in the same way that innovation of highly processed food in the mid-20th century led to a global health crisis, the unintended side effects of digital communication tools, a sort of social fast food, are proving to be similarly worrisome. The social media paradox. Determining the impact of digital communication tools on our psychological well-being is complicated. There's no shortage of scientific studies examining this topic, but different groups draw different conclusions from the same literature. Consider two contrasting takes on this topic that were both published around the same time in 2017. The first was an NPR story posted in March of that year, which summarized the results of a pair of big deal new studies about the connection between social media use and well-being. Both studies found strong correlations between social media use and a range of negative factors, from perceived isolation to poor physical health. The NPR study's title summarized these findings well. Feeling lonely? Too much time on social media might be why. Not long after this NPR article came out, two members of Facebook's internal research team published a blog post defending this service against a rising tide of criticism that had begun in the aftermath of the contentious 2016 election. In this post, the authors acknowledge that some uses of social media might make people less happy, but then point to several research studies that establish that when used properly, these services make subjects measurably happier. Using Facebook to keep in touch with friends and loved ones, the authors note, brings us joy and strengthens our sense of community. In other words, depending on whom you ask, social media is either making us lonely or bringing us joy. To better understand this general phenomenon of contrasting conclusions, let's look closer at the specific studies summarized above. One of the main positive articles cited by a Facebook blog post was authored by Moira Burke, a data scientist at the company who also co-authored the blog post, and Robert Kraut, a human-computer interaction specialist at Carnegie Mellon University. It was published in the Journal of Computer Mediated Communication in July 2016. In this study, Burke and Kraut recruited a group of around 1,900 Facebook users who agreed to quantify their current level of happiness when prompted. The researchers, when then used the Facebook server logs to connect specific social media activities with these well-being scores. They found that when users received targeted and composed information written by someone they know well, for example, a comment sent by a family member, they felt better. On the other hand, receiving a targeted and composed information from someone they didn't know well, or received a like, or reading a status update broadcast to many people, didn't correlate with improved well-being. Another positive article cited in the Facebook post was authored by social psychologist Finn Detters from the Freie Universität Berlin and Matthias Miehl from the University of Arizona. It appears in a journal called Social Psychology and the Personality Science back in September 2013. In this study, Miehl and Detters deployed a controlled experiment. During a one-week period, some subjects were asked to make more Facebook posts than normal, while the others were given no instructions. The experimental group, who were asked to post more, ended up reporting less loneliness than the control group during this week. Closer questioning revealed that this was due primarily to feeling more connected to their friends on a daily basis. These two studies seem to paint a compelling picture of social media boosting happiness and banishing loneliness. But let's now muddy the waters by considering the main two negative studies cited in the NPR article that came out during the same period as the Facebook post. The first of these studies was authored by a large team from diverse disciplines, led by Brian Primrak from the University of Pittsburgh. It appeared in the prestigious American Journal of Preventive Medicine in July 2017. Primrak and his team surveyed a nationally representative sample of adults between the ages of 19 and 22 using the same type of random sample techniques that pollsters deploy to measure public opinions during elections. The survey asked a standard set of questions that measured the subject's perceived social isolation, a loneliness metric. It also asked about usage of 11 different major social media platforms. After crunching the numbers, the researchers found that the more someone used social media, the more likely they were to be lonely. Indeed, someone in the highest quartile of social media use was 3 times more likely to be lonelier than someone in the lowest quartile. These results held up even after the researchers controlled for factors such as race, gender, relationship status, household income, and education. Primrak admitted to NPR that he was surprised by the results. It's social media, so aren't people supposed to be socially connected? But the data was clear. The more time you spend connecting on these services, the more isolated you're likely to become. The other study cited in the NPR article was authored by Holly Shakya of the University of California, San Diego, and Nicholas Christakis of Yale, and it appears in the American Journal of Epidemiology in February 2017. Shakya and Christakis used data from over 5,200 subjects from a nationally representative panel combined with observed Facebook behavior of the subjects. They studied associations between Facebook activity and self-reported measures of physical health, mental health, and life satisfaction, among other quality of life metrics. As they reported, our results show that overall the use of Facebook was negatively associated with well-being. They found, for example, that if you increase the amount of likes or links clicked by a standard deviation, mental health decreases by 5 to 8% of a standard deviation. These negative connections still held when, like in the Primrak study, they controlled for relevant demographic variables. These dueling studies seem to present a paradox. Social media makes you feel both connected and lonely, happy and sad. I want to stop here because I believe this is an incredibly profound point to dig into before we move. We'll be back in 1 second to break down this incredible quote from Cal Newport in 1 second. All right, here's what Cal says. These dueling studies seem to present a paradox. Social media makes you feel both connected and lonely, happy and sad. Isn't that true about life? It'd be nice if we could easily categorize everything into good and bad, but life rarely works that way. There's too much nuance, too much gray. Here's what I want to say to all the leaders out there. Your success as a leader will depend on you being able to navigate gray areas like social media well. The best leaders, in fact, the very essence of leadership is being able to navigate the uncertain with wisdom. This is why we need to be readers. It allows us to build our wisdom and experience bank so that we can cash in when faced with a tough choice where both options look bad and where we have very little experience. That's true leadership. Reading prepares the leader by helping them stand on the experience of those who have come before them so that they can navigate through tough circumstances, having never been through the circumstance itself. As leaders, let's embrace uncertainty and start building the banks of wisdom so we can cash in and lead others down the road to success. One great way to do this is by starting to pick up biographies of great leaders throughout time. You get to live their life, you get to see their experience, and you get to cash in on their wisdom without actually having going through the experience yourself. All right, back to the book. To resolve this paradox, let's start by looking closer at the experimental designs described above. The studies that found positive results focused on specific behaviors of social media users, while the studies that found negative results focused on overall use of these services. The natural assumption is that these variables would be positively connected. If common social media behaviors increased well-being, then the more you use these services, the more of these mood-boosting behaviors you'll engage in, and the happier you should be. Therefore, after reading the positive studies, you would expect that increasing social media use would increase well-being. But this, of course, was the opposite of what the researchers discovered in the negative studies. There must therefore be another factor at play, something that increases the more you use social media, generating negative impacts that swamp out the smaller positive boosts. Fortunately for our investigation, Holly Shakya identified a likely suspect for this factor. The more you use social media to interact with your network, the less time you devote to offline communication. What we know at this point, Shakya told NPR, is that we have evidence that replacing your real-world relationships with social media use is detrimental to your well-being. To help explore this idea, Shakya and Christakis also measured offline interactions and found they were associated with positive effects, a finding that has been widely replicated in the social psychology literature. As they then noted, the negative associations of Facebook use are comparable in magnitude to the positive impact of offline interactions, suggesting a trade-off. The problem then is not that social media directly makes us unhappy. Indeed, as the positive study cited above found, certain social media activities, when isolated in an experiment, modestly boost well-being. The key issue is that using social media tends to take people away from the real-world socializing that's massively more valuable. As the negative studies imply, the more you use social media, the less time you tend to devote to offline interaction, and therefore, the worse this value deficit becomes, leaving the heaviest social media users much more likely to be lonely and miserable. The small boost you receive from posting on a friend's wall or liking their latest Instagram photo can't come close to compensating for the large loss experienced by no longer spending real-world time with that same friend. As Shakya summarizes, where we want to be cautious is when the sound of a voice or a cup of coffee with a friend is replaced with likes on a post. The idea that real-world interactions are more valuable than online interactions isn't surprising. Our brains evolved during a period when the only communication was offline and face-to-face. As argued earlier in the chapter, these offline interactions are incredibly rich because they require our brains to process large amounts of information about subtle analog cues such as body language, facial expressions, and voice tone. The low bandwidth chatter supported by many digital communication tools might offer a simulacrum of this connection, but it leaves most of our high-performance social processing networks underused, reducing these tools' ability to satisfy our intense sociality. This is why the value generated by Facebook comment or Instagram like, although real, is minor compared to the value generated by an analog conversation or shared real-world activity. We don't have good data on why people trade online for offline communication when given access to digital communication tools, but it's easy to generate convincing hypotheses based on common experience. An obvious culprit is that online interaction is both easier and faster than old-fashioned conversation. Humans are naturally biased toward activities that require less energy in the short term, even if it's more harmful in the long term. So we end up texting our sibling instead of calling them on the phone, or liking a picture of a friend's new baby instead of stopping by to visit. A subtler effect is the way the digital communication tools can subvert the offline communication that remains in your life. Because our primal instinct to connect is so strong, it's difficult to resist checking a device in the middle of a conversation with a friend or bath time with a child, reducing the quality of the richer interaction right in front of us. Our analog brain cannot easily distinguish between the importance of the person in the room with us and the person who just sent us a new text. Finally, as detailed in the first part of the book, many of these tools are engineered to hijack our social instincts to create an addictive allure. When you spend multiple hours a day compulsively clicking and swiping, there's much less free time left for slower interactions. And because this compulsive use emits a patina of socialness, it can delude you into thinking that you're already serving your relationships well, making further action unnecessary. To state the obvious, this account doesn't cover all the possible dangers of digital communication tools. Critics have also highlighted the ability for social media to make us feel ostracized or inadequate, as well as to stoke exhausting outrage, inflame our worst tribal instincts, and perhaps even degrade the democratic process itself. For the remainder of this chapter, however, I want to bypass a discussion of the potential pathologies of the social media universe and keep our focus on the zero-sum relationship between online and offline interaction. I believe this to be the most fundamental of the issues caused by the digital communication era and the key trap that a minimalist must understand in trying to successfully navigate the pluses and minuses of these new tools. Reclaiming conversation. Up to this point in the chapter, we've relied on some clunky terminology to differentiate interaction mediated through text interfaces and mobile screens from the old-fashioned analog communication our species evolved to crave. Going forward, I want to borrow some useful phrasing from MIT professor Sherry Turkle, a leading researcher on the subjective experience of technology. In her 2015 book, Reclaiming Conversation, Turkle draws a distinction between connection, her word for the low bandwidth interactions that define our online social lives, and conversation, the much richer, high bandwidth communication that defines real world encounters between humans. Turkle agrees with our premise that conversation is crucial. Face-to-face conversation is the most human and humanizing thing we do. Fully present to one another, we learn to listen. It's where we develop the capacity for empathy. It's where we experience the joy of being heard, of being understood. In her book, Turkle presents anthropological case studies that highlight the same flight from conversation that was captured by the quantitative studies cited earlier in this chapter. And in doing so, she puts a human face on the decreased well-being that occurs when conversation is replaced with connection. Turkle, for example, introduces her readers to middle school students who struggle with empathy, as they lack the practice of reading facial cues that comes from conversation, as well as a 34-year-old colleague who comes to realize her online interactions all have an exhausting element of performance that have led her to the point where the line between the real and performed is blurring. Turning her attention to the workplace, Turkle finds young employees who retreat to email because the thought of an unstructured conversation terrifies them, and unnecessary office tensions that fester when communication shifts from nuanced conversation to ambiguous connection. During an appearance on the Colbert Report, host Stephen Colbert asked Turkle a profound question that gets at the core of her argument. Don't all these little tweets, these little sips of online connection add up to one big gulp of real conversation? Turkle was clear in her answer. No, they do not. As she expands, face-to-face conversation unfolds slowly. It teaches patience. We attend to tone and nuance. On the other hand, when we communicate on our digital devices, we learn different habits. As a true digital minimalist, Turkle approaches these issues from a standpoint of smarter use of digital communication tools, not blanket abstention. My argument is not anti-technology, she writes. It's pro-conversation. She's confident that we can make the necessary changes to reclaim the conversation we need to thrive, noting that despite the seriousness of the moment, she remains optimistic that once we recognize the issues and replacing conversation with connection, we can rethink our practices. I share Turkle's optimism that there's a minimalist solution to this problem, but I'm more pessimistic about the magnitude of effort required. Toward the end of her book, Turkle offers a series of recommendations which center in large part on the idea of making more space in your life for quality conversations. The objective of this recommendation is faultless, but its effectiveness is questionable. As argued earlier in the chapter, digital communication tools, if used without intention, have a way of forcing a trade-off between conversation and connection. If you don't first reform your relationship with tools like social media and text messaging, attempts to shoehorn more conversation into your life are likely to fail. It can't simply be digital business as usual, augmented with more time for authentic conversation. The shift in behavior will need to be more fundamental. To succeed with digital minimalism, you have to confront this rebalancing between conversations and connection in a way that makes sense to you. To prime your thinking along these lines, however, I will present in the following pages a somewhat radical solution, a philosophy of sorts for socializing in a digital age that I personally find to be appealing. I refer to this philosophy by the superfluously alliterative name conversation-centric communication. You can moderate these ideas as needed to accommodate the idiosyncratic realities of your social life or reject them altogether, but you cannot avoid the need to think about solutions to these issues that are comparably aggressive. Many people think about conversation and connection as two different strategies for accomplishing the same goal of maintaining their social life. The mindset believes that there are many different ways to tend important relationships in your life. And in our current modern moment, you should use all tools available, spanning from old-fashioned face-to-face talking to tapping the heart icon on a friend's Instagram post. The philosophy of conversation-centric communication takes a harder stance. It argues that conversation is the only form of interaction that in some sense counts towards maintaining a relationship. This conversation can take the form of a face-to-face meeting, or it can be a video chat or a phone call, so long as it matches Sherry Turkle's criteria of involving nuanced analog cues, such as the tone of your voice or facial expressions. Anything textual or non-interactive, basically all social media, email, text, and instant messaging doesn't count as conversation and should instead be categorized as mere connection. In this philosophy, connection is downgraded to a logistical role. This form of interaction now has two goals: to help set up and arrange conversation, or to efficiently transfer practical information, for example, a meeting location or time of an upcoming event. Connection is no longer an alternative to conversation. It's instead a supporter. If you subscribe to conversation-centric communication, you might still maintain some social media accounts for the purposes of logistical expediency, but gone will be the habit of regularly browsing these services throughout your day, sprinkling likes and short comments, or posting your own updates and desperately checking for feedback they accrue. With this in mind, there would no longer be much purpose in keeping these apps on your phone, where they will mainly be serving to undermine your attempts at richer communication. They would instead more productively reside on your computer, where they occasionally put to specific use. All right, let's not skip past this brilliant suggestion from Cal. Like we mentioned in a previous episode, environment matters. Check out our episode, Why Motivation is Overrated, to learn more about that. And nowhere does environment matter more these days than how you set up your phone. Cal is saying that if we want to maximize our relationships, it seems we might be best served removing apps that are diminishing our relationships experience from our phone, forcing us to opt for the real thing. I've tried this, and I am loving it. I have no social media apps on my phone except Instagram, which must have read Cal's book because they only let you post content on your phone. On top of that, I only give myself 7 minutes of a day on Instagram, and the results I've found is that investing in relationships in a more personal way, I'm getting so much more out of those relationships. It's forcing me to do it, and I'm really glad that it's forcing me to use phone calls, video chats, face-to-face conversations to build my relationships. I'd recommend it to you as well. I'd say take this one all the way to the bank. It's gold. All right, let's get back to the book. Similarly, if you adopt conversation-centric communication, you'll still likely rely on text messaging services to simplify information gathering or to coordinate social events or to ask quick questions, but you'll no longer participate in open-ended, ongoing text-based conversations throughout your day. The socializing that counts is real conversation, and text is no longer a sufficient alternative. Notice, in true minimalist fashion, conversation-centric communication doesn't ask that you abandon the wonders of digital communication tools. On the contrary, this philosophy recognizes that these tools can enable significant improvements to your social life. Among other advantages, these new technologies greatly simplify the process of arranging conversation. When you unexpectedly find yourself free on a weekend afternoon, a quick round of text can efficiently identify a friend available to join you for a walk. Similarly, a social media service might alert you that an old friend is going to be in town, prompting you to arrange a dinner. Innovations in digital communication also provide cheap and effective ways to banish the obstacle of distance and seeking conversation. When my sister was living in Japan, we would regularly converse over FaceTime, deciding to place a call based on the same spur-of-the-moment inspiration with which you might casually drop in on a relative living down the street. At any other period of human history, this capability would have been considered miraculous. In short, this philosophy has nothing against technology, as long as the tools are put to use to improve your real-world social life as opposed to diminishing it. To be clear, conversation-centric communication requires sacrifices. If you adopt this philosophy, you'll almost certainly reduce the number of people with whom you have an active relationship. Real conversation takes time, and the total number of people for which you can uphold this standard will be significantly less than the total number of people you can follow, retweet, like, and occasionally leave a comment for on social media, or ping with the occasional text. Once you no longer count the latter activities as meaningful interaction, your social circle will seem to contract at first. This sense of contraction, however, is illusory. As I have argued throughout this chapter, conversation is the good stuff. It's what we crave as humans and what provides us with a sense of community and belonging necessary to thrive. Connection, on the other hand, through appealing in the moment, provides very little of what we need. In the early days of adopting a conversation-centric mindset, you might miss the security blanket of what Stephen Colbert astutely labels little sips of online connection. And the sudden loss of weak ties to the fringes of your social network might induce moments of loneliness. But as you trade more of this time for conversation, the richness of these analog interactions will far outweigh what you leave behind. In her book, Sherry Turkle summarizes research that found just 5 days at a camp with no phones or internet was enough to induce major increases in the camper's well-being and sense of connection. It won't take many walks with a friend or pleasantly meandering phone calls before you begin to wonder why you previously felt it was so important to turn away from the person sitting right in front of you to leave a comment on your cousin's friend's Instagram feed. Man, I love that chapter, and Cal Newport is the man when it comes to maximizing your productivity and for addressing the challenges technology is laying in our laps these days. There's more to this chapter, absolutely, and way more leadership gold in his book, Digital Minimalism. If you want to buy it, use the link in our show notes. You'll get a great book at no extra cost to you, and we'll get a portion of the proceeds to keep bringing you the best laser-focused leadership content we can. And you'll begin mastering the digital world. That's our fourth book for your next chapter. Next week, we'll close this series with one more book and be coaching you to ring it out for every ounce of leadership growth. Can't wait to see you then. This is your host, Jake Welchens. And remember, life's too short for bad books. If you know someone out there who would benefit from today's episode, please share. Let's build this thing together. I absolutely need your help. To connect or see what I'm reading right now, follow me on my Instagram at Jake Welchens or my Goodreads profile at www.goodreads.com/Jake Welchens. This podcast is brought to you by the Launchpad Podcast Collection and performed and written by myself, Jake Welchens. Podcast production by the one and only Logan Bongean. See you next time on Readout.